16?
That's okay.
Welcome to the stuff that's in Module 10. That'll do. And this morning we are going to talk about cabling a network. How serendipitous, because that's what we were talking about before we got started. Before I get started, well, get started on what's actually being recorded, has anybody got any questions, queries, confusions? We don't have many more weeks to go. Probably we'll finish around the end of December. I don't have a calendar handy, but if somebody does, we'll probably be finishing around before Christmas time. So whatever that works out to be.
No, wait, aren't we module 9 today? Because I thought we did 8 last week, and then now we're on 9.
9 was the physical layer being split into the LLC and stuff, wasn't it? And the Ethernet standards, Xerox 1985, all that sort of stuff. Haven't we done all that?
Not unless I missed something.
No, Jason's right. You did 8 last week.
Oh, all right. Well, I suppose I'll do 9 this week then. Well, yeah, okay. I think I probably looked at the top of it and went, gee, that's boring, I'll go on to this one. And I probably can't do that, so let's go back and do the one before it.
For what it's worth, I sort of agree with you.
Oh, yeah, I think we probably all do. It looks like here the Tuesday U.S. time before Christmas is December 20.
All right, well, let's aim to be done by then with official lectures, but I will still be around and there may be a little more time to do things after that date. And if anybody wants to play in early January, I will be around, so we could still do something else if anybody feels motivated to do that. That's the time scale we're trying to work towards.
Sounds good.
Okay, let's get into Module 9 Ethernet. Hey, we might even get through Module 9 and 10 today. Who knows? We'll see how we go. Or at least the talking about the stuff that's in there. And that's all good. Also, Grace, if Alex is trying to listen to this lecture, are you trying to listen to this lecture? Or not, Alex? Did you want to jump on Ventrilo because you won't be able to hear through Grace, or will you be right? All right. Okay, all right. So we'll try and do Modules 9 and 10, or at least Module 9, and see how we feel after Module 9. Summarise what's in these things and make sure everybody understands bits and pieces. And we will then go on, and I think we're going to... Okay. Has anyone on here ever seen, out of morbid curiosity, has anybody ever seen coaxial Ethernet, 10Base2 Ethernet? Has anyone been around long enough to see that?
Is that the stuff with the BNC connectors on?
BNC connectors, and the little twisty things, you push them on and twist and they lock on. Bayonet Nielsen or something, I think it's what BNC stands for. I think BNC connector is like ATM machine, but that's okay, we'll forgive you. And you've got T-pieces and you've got little terminators that go on the end. Little 50-ohm terminators that have a BNC on them and you push them in and turn them. Does anybody remember, I mean it was probably the early 80s, but the old video players used to have BNC in and out. And if you look at some really crusty old monitors, they've actually got 5 BNC connectors on them for red, green, blue, horizontal sync and vertical sync. Has anyone seen any of that stuff around?
The BNCs are still around for RF equipment, and it's a horrid connector because, well, they're fine if you never use them, but they wear easily and they get loose, and they're a horrible connector.
I thought they'd moved to those, I can't remember, they're 259 or a 229 or something, the ones that are sort of, have got the pin in the middle and you screw down the outside metal thing onto them on RF equipment now, or do some people still insist on having BNC?
Well, no, your final 50 ohm coax runs are the PL259. It's a lot more robust, but for the smaller gauge 50 ohm stuff for patch cables and things, there's still a lot of BNC out there, and they're high maintenance. That's whenever you have a weak link, defy and start there.
Hey, fair enough. All right. Okay, the original standard was done in 1980 by. So I think are you trying to get Grace's attention?
Yes.
Oh. So Grace, I think Alex wanted to talk to you.
What's that?
Oh, you've got it, have you? All sorted.
Yes.
CiscaVision.org. Yes. We're not paid enough to be .com. Now. Hey, digital equipment. Digital equipment, Xerox and Intel. It was called the PDIX standard, which is said as dicks if you're using Eloquence. That's kind of funny. Let's not dwell on that too much. But it is PDIX, so fix your dictionary. It was standardized by the IEEE in 1985. And they did 802.3, but they made a couple of changes. They changed the length field, which was in the headers, to a length slash type field. When Ethernet originally came out, you could only run one protocol per LAN segment, per card. That's just tedious. Has anyone had the misfortune of dealing with Novell NetWare, IPX, SPX, IPX ODI, LSL, and the link-specific driver? Does anybody remember that badness from the early to mid-90s, or were you guys not involved in networking at that point?
They were getting rid of it when I came into university.
Yeah, that was DOS stuff. You'd load LSL, and then you'd load the MLID-specific driver, or whatever it was called, and then you would load IPX ODI, and then you'd do your net login to log into your Novell NetWare server. And we all had to care about IPX SPX, because that was the only way you could play Warcraft under DOS. So, no prizes for guessing whose job it was to get the network drivers running on all of the people's gaming PCs. Okay, so the data link... The data link layer is divided into 802.2, which is the LLC, which is 802.2, and the media access control layer. Now, the Ethernet is defined by your physical layer protocols and your data link protocols. So you're looking at layers 1 and 2 of the OSI reference model. Layer 1 is your physical cables, voltages, the bits on the wire, all that sort of stuff, which we went through last week. And the MAC sublayer handles physical components. So that's where you have your transceiver and stuff. Has anybody ever seen when you... If you've ever seen a network card and you've actually looked at the network card, there's like the bit on the board where the RJ45 comes in, then there's this blocky thing, and then there's the chip, and then there's a few other capacitors and stuff. Well, the blocky thing basically is your MAC controller, your MAC and your physical layer controller, and it's responsible for actually putting these signals on the wire.
Cool, I've seen that. I didn't know exactly what that was.
A cube shape thing?
Yeah, pretty much. It's sort of cubey and squarey, and it's got the transformer logic to do the voltages and stuff. I'm not exactly sure of the actual breakdown of all of the components. You'd have to go and look at like one of Realtek's data sheets. But yeah, that's the actual thing that's responsible for putting the signals on the wires. Okay, now the things you've got to know about layer 1 and the MAC controller, which is why we have the LLC sublayer, is that layer 1 cannot communicate with upper layers. It doesn't know how to. Cannot identify devices, so it doesn't know anything about the hardware addresses and stuff. That is an LLC feature. Only recognizes streams of bits. Cannot figure out who's transmitting if multiple people are transmitting at once, which is less of a problem for stars and extended star topologies, but was quite a big problem on coax. Okay, so your layer 2 functions. It connects to the upper layers via LLC, logical link control. Uses addressing schemes, MAC addresses, 48 bits long, 24 bits OUI, 24 bits serial number. We've gone through that a few times, so I'm not going to dwell on that too much. Uses frames to organize bits into groups. Can anybody tell me what is the approximate length of an average Ethernet frame?
Isn't that like 48 bytes?
No.
I remember reading about a minimum of 64 bytes or something.
Yep, there's a minimum of 64, and your average Ethernet frames are 1500 bytes. That's your MTU on a lot of things. Like, if you look at the MTU on your Ethernet interface, and that it'll be set to 1500 because your frame size is 1500 bytes. Okay, the stuff that the LLC uses, or the things that the LLC does, makes the connection with the upper layers. So that's layer 3 and that sort of thing. Framing the network layer packet. Identifying the network layer protocol, which is done in that length/type field. And it remains relatively independent of the physical equipment. So depending on whether you use fiber, depending on whether you're using Ethernet, it doesn't really make any difference to the LLC sublayer. Any questions so far? We haven't covered anything too amazing, but has anybody got any questions that have come up so far? We'll have to get people to start typing no into chat, I think, because this will make this go on a lot faster. It's okay, you don't have to type no this time. Okay, you've got a list of medias you can have. So you've got 10 base 5, 500 meters maximum length, 50 ohm coax N-type connector. I'm sure some of you will have seen those before. You've got 10 base 2, 185 meters maximum length, 50 ohm coaxial BNC connector. You have 100 meters maximum length of 100 ohm UTP RJ45. And those are the types of connectors they're some of the types of medias you can have on Ethernet. You can also have 100 base TX, and I've already covered that one. You can also have 1000 base CX, 25 meters, 150 ohm shielded twisted pair. You don't see a lot of that. You can also have multimode fiber, which can run from 220 meters up to 550 meters, and that's got a subscriber connector on it. That's gigabit. It used to be 100 megabit, but you can now run gigabit on fiber. And you can also have the 550 to 5 kilometers single mode fiber, which is obviously more expensive because you're using lasers instead of just regular light signals. Your MAC layer encapsulates data. It provides three primary functions. Frame delimiting, in other words, where does one frame start, where does one frame end? Addressing, and error detection. At the end of every frame, we have a CRC that is added, and the CRC is designed to detect transmission errors, and there is a high probability that the frame was received okay. CRCs are probabilistic, so there is the possibility of two data sets generating the same CRC, but the probability is high enough so that it doesn't happen too often. The reason people like Ethernet is its simplicity and ease of maintenance. You can buy one of those My First Ethernet kits. I don't think Toys R Us sell them yet, but Harvey Norman certainly do, and your other sort of stores, and it's got like a couple of cables and one of those switchy things, or you get like one of those multifunction routers from your ISP, and they throw in a couple of extra patch leads at no extra cost. That's the sort of ease of installation. People can still manage to get Ethernet wrong, but generally speaking, you plug those weird square connectors with the tunkers on them into the holes in the switch, and then you plug the machines in the other end, and pretty much most of the time it works. Ethernet has the ability to incorporate new technologies. It's reliable. generally speaking. Ethernet doesn't go bad too often. For anybody who's used to running wireless networks, how often do... how many times have you seen wireless networks go down and the Ethernet ones are just fine? Let me close Dropbox because somebody's decided to do file maintenance and that's always a little bit disruptive. Low cost of installation and upgrade, that's always a good thing. I don't know if anybody remembers back in like the mid-90s and stuff, or even the late 90s, I paid $143.50 for a D-Link 5-port. It was a gigabit switch. Yeah, 5-port gigabit switch for $143, and that was cheap. I don't know, how long ago did you guys buy your first hubs and switches? Weren't they nice and expensive a while ago?
In the late 90s, even though...
Yeah, go ahead, Kevin.
In the late 90s, I think I bought a switch in 99 or something, and it was already fairly expensive, and it wasn't a gigabit.
You were going to say something, Corey, I think?
Oh, I just said yes, they were.
Yeah, look, I remember the budget-conscious home had, like, two computers and a crossover cable because those hub things were really expensive. Obviously, things have become a lot cheaper since then. I mean, even the price of those multifunction routers and stuff has fallen. You can get quite cheap ones. You might not want to, but you could.
There was a time in the late 90s when...
Go ahead. You're right.
When my friends would have LAN parties because they were sighted and they'd play StarCraft and stuff, and I would always get invited because I was the only one that had a Switch.
Yes, let's not get into a discussion of the inclusion and exclusion of blind people due to what technology they do and don't have. We can save that for a fireside chat. I used to get invited because I could set up the aforementioned IPX SPX drivers back in the early 90s. I knew how to do that exclude the memory window thing in EMM386 that used to confuse all my friends mightily. Now, frames remain the same across all types of Ethernet, fiber, copper, etc. I think I've mentioned before, I've talked about Aloha before, haven't I?
Yeah, I think you briefly mentioned it.
The communication on the islands?
Yeah, that's the one where they're asking each other how much pineapple they had left. I'm pretty sure I've said that before, where they all listen for silence, they then transmit, if two people transmit, there's a back off, and then somebody retransmits again. I'm pretty sure I did mention that.
You did.
Okay, the original Ethernet used shared bus topology. In other words, you had one run of cable from... one end to the other. You had a terminator on the end of each cable, and you had T connectors that connected onto each of the backs of the PCs, and if you wanted to get out of work at TAFE and you happened to be on the end machine, you'd rip the terminator off the end and then explain to the teacher that the network was down. Sadly, they wised up to this and had a couple of terminators in the front desk just for that occasion. The problem with physical bus, as all of you cable television users would know, is that the more people you get on the cable, the slower everything goes. Is anybody on here using cable, or are we all using something different?
I am.
I wish I was.
At the risk of a lawsuit, I'm sure you wish you weren't using Charter as well. Okay, moving right along.
Yeah, I have cable as
well. Okay, have you guys noticed any slowdown problems at times, like when the network gets loaded and stuff, or all the pimply-faced teenagers are torrenting? Or do you guys usually... does it work pretty well for you guys?
I'm alright, but I'm probably the only one in my area that's killing it, so...
I used to see that years ago, but I think they've changed how the local loops work here, and plus I usually get around 25 MIPS pretty consistently, so it doesn't seem to matter anymore.
Okay. What sort of up speeds do you guys get on cable now? Because I remember my brother had cable and he was getting like 400k a second down and like, 8k a second up.
I get 25 megabits down and I think 250k up.
Yeah, I seem to recollect that the up speed is... Sorry, Matthew, go ahead.
No, that was the same for me. It used to be that was always the problem, but I don't know. Maybe I'm just lucky. I get two MIPS up.
Ah, look out. You'll have Corey moving into your house because you get more up speed. You can torrent more Linux distributions and give back to the community. On another note, I saw an article the other day that there are actually UK ISPs disconnecting file sharers, so, fun in a box. Okay, physical devices. Somebody wanted me to run a Thursday chat on torrenting, but I sort of argued that I really didn't want to be condoning that sort of behaviour, and I didn't want to be showing people how to set up Peer Guardian because that wasn't something that the Academy wanted to be seen doing. Not that I would know anything about that at all either, so I really wouldn't be qualified to run that sort of chat.
Ironically enough, my ISP actually has a help file on their webpage on how to set up a torrent client.
Really?
Why?
Go to sha.ca and search for it.
Oh, wow. Okay.
That's the Canadian law system for you.
I have a little adage that says that unless you're doing something illegal on your internet connection, it is highly unlikely that you will need more than 100 gigabits of bandwidth a month. Gigabytes of bandwidth a month. And given the way that people tend to watch TV off torrents, I stand behind that adage. I really do.
There is Netflix.
Not in Australia, there isn't.
When you said Thursday chats, that reminded me, is Ian still going to do his second IPv6 thing?
I was hoping so. I've got to ask him. He should be back over this afternoon, so I'll ask him this afternoon and see whether he's still going to do it. Did anybody, just before we get back to the exciting thing that is Chapter 9, did anybody want any more or different on IPv6 than I did in the first chat? Has anybody listened to the first IPv6 chat that wasn't there, or anything? Or is it just one of these things that we sit on our server and...
No, the first one was quite good. I actually would like to listen to it a second time. I learned quite a bit.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I have to catch the beginning, though, as I wasn't there from the beginning.
Well, I'm just wondering if there's any interest in me actually going through how you set up the tunneling client, the TSPC tunneling client, and that sort of stuff. Would that be something that people would be interested in looking at?
I would.
Oh yeah, that would be a great part two for the practical side of it.
Yeah, I haven't listened to part one yet. It's on my list of things to do, but I haven't gotten there yet.
Would it help if I made a podcast feed for them all, or would or not really? Because I had sort of thought about that.
That would be cool.
I would make use of that if there were such a thing.
It's called Cavi on your iOS device.
Well, that's sort of... Well, believe it or not, there are other podcatchers, but yes, that would be the primary application. Alright, people, well, I'll try and make that happen. So, you are being warned in advance. Please back up your iTunes library before you even try this, and I will let you all know when the podcast feed goes live, and if it fills up your iTunes library or your iPod, then you were warned. So, make sure you've got backups of that iTunes library. We've all got our iTunes libraries backed up, haven't we? Yes? We actually have, but I think a lot of people don't.
Insanely enough, I do.
Once you get it working and we test it, you should submit it to the directory. It'd just be one more channel of exposure for Cavi, why not?
Yeah, the other thing I was going to do too is get in touch with iBlink, Ceratech, and see if they'll add it to iBlink's feed.
They put mine in there, so I'm sure they'll put yours in.
Alrighty. Okay, back to wandering off topic, back to wandering on topic.
I do it.
But, the actual... the actual time taken for the podcast is not actually getting Dirtcaster running. It's actually sitting down and ID3 tagging all of the podcasts. So that's my excuse, and I'm sticking to it. Okay, Hubs. Yes. But are you volunteering to write the regular expressions for me to turn the file names into meaningful tags? Because I'd be quite happy to delegate that off.
that's nice of you, Cork.
Well, I'm just explaining. We're all in love with mp3tag.de, but unless you haven't realized, the documentation is disgracefully out of date, and the regular expressions are certainly a challenge.
Yeah, I just usually cheat and select all, and never had to do anything too substantial to that degree.
I'm a little bit of a stickler for niceties and stuff. If a podcast feed's going to come up, I want sensible things to show up on your iPod, because I really hate it when people don't do that on mine, and I don't think I deserve doing it to everybody else.
Fair enough. Pearl's good for that.
What's good for that?
Pearl is good for regular expressions and file naming and stuff.
Yeah. They use the same PCRE library inside of MP3 tags, so yeah, it's good. Okay. Hubs concentrated signals, and they use star topology. If anybody's seen a hub, they take the signal from one port and reflect it back to all of the other ports except for the port that the signal came in on. That's important, and they probably ask you something about it in the tests on the way through, so that's why I mention it. Hubs turn a logical bus into a physical star. Now, would anybody like me to explain that a little bit more, or does anybody understand what I mean when I say that? Grace, just be careful, my microphone's a bit sensitive. Does everybody understand? You want me to elaborate? Okay, good. You guys are aware that there are two types of topology. There is the physical topology, which is how stuff is actually laid out. So you've got... Did I talk about ring, bus, star, and mesh? I'm pretty sure I did.
Yeah, we did go over that.
Okay, well, I'll rehash anyway, but just so that we know. So, a bus is where things go from one end to the other. If you picture, like, a bus going from the depot, brum, 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 picks up all the old ladies and they're shopping, and then it turns around and it comes back and it goes brum, 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 except networks don't do that because that would be really noisy. And that is a bus. Then you have a star, which has got a device at the center of the topology, like a hub. And then all of the machines hang off the edges. And you have a ring, which is the one that goes round and round in a circle. And then you have a mesh, which is where every other machine connects to every other machine for extremely high reliability. So they are your physical topologies. Now, the physical topology is how the actual devices are laid out, but the logical topology is how the actual packets travel on the actual mediums. And the logical topology is not something that you can physically perceive. It's something that happens inside the network devices. So what they're saying is that a hub, because it sends it in one port and out all of the others, turns a physical star into... It turns a physical star into a logical bus. So, in other words, it's laid out in a star shape, but the physical topology is actually the logical topology is your bus and your physical is the star. Does that make any more sense?
Yeah, I think it's one of those things that's easier to picture than it probably is to explain.
Yeah, I think so. Do you see mesh topologies much anymore? Like, is that something that's used a lot?
Not usually. Where they are sometimes used is on, like, does anybody remember those one laptop per child things that you could get? They had, like, a wireless mesh topology on them where every other laptop talked to every other laptop. And it was so everybody could, like, network and stuff on the wireless network, the ad hoc wireless network that they all worked on. I don't know whether they still exist, those things, or whether they've gone, you know, whether they've disappeared into the nether, you know, nowhere land.
I believe there's some military applications for mesh also for the redundancy.
Yeah. Some ham radio operators and stuff mess with mesh on packet to a degree as well. As far as I know, but it's not quite network mesh, but it gets close. Okay, but now, hubs were all well and good, except they found out that as collisions increased, the efficiency of the network dropped, and once you got over 60% collisions, things would tend to go really slow and stuff. Which is why they introduced switches, which were meant to limit the effects of collisions on your local area network. They're saying here that modern installations use 1 gigabit Ethernet. Anybody on here still running 100 meg? It's okay if you are, we're not going to pick on you.
I am.
Yeah, my router is okay. 100 meg. I'm wireless right now, but it does do 100 meg Ethernet.
I have both.
Yeah, I used to run 100 megabit, and then I started shoveling CD and DVD images around the network, and I discovered that copying 600 meg of stuff at 100 megabit, you could actually go and make a coffee. But, I mean, for general use, unless you're shoveling big files around the networks, like if the biggest file you throw around your network is an MP3, then you're probably good to go. But you are going to find that... You are actually going to have speed problems with 100 megabit. The other unrelated thing I was going to mention, because I just thought of it, is if you are backing up your iTunes library, which everybody should, the utilities you should be looking into is rsync if you're on a Mac. Rsync is very cool. Karen's Replicator if you'd like a GUI for your Windows, or RoboCopy. I think we did a Thursday chat, if you look back through the archives, and soon-to-be podcast feed, TM, you will also be able to find one where we talked about synchronization tools.
I remember looking at the documentation for rsync once and feeling terribly confused.
Oh, no, this is easy. The first thing you have to ask yourself with rsync is, exactly what do I want to preserve? And when I want to preserve those things, how do I actually want to do it? Do I want to do subdirectories, or do I want to do permissions? Do I want to do timestamps? What I do is dash A preserves all of the permissions and stuff. V is verbose, capital P is for partial and progress. But the other one I use is RVT, which is recursive, verbose, and timestamps. And that's about all you really need to know. Anything else is icing on the cake. Okay, now the notes here are saying that the minimum length is 64 bytes and the maximum length of an Ethernet frame is 1,518 bytes, which is from the destination address all the way through to the frame check sequence. It doesn't include the 8-byte preamble. In 1998, the 802.3ac standard, I think. Let's see. Yes, the 802.3ac standard extended the frames to 1522 bytes, and that was including a VLAN ID. So that was an extra 2 bytes for your VLAN ID, which I think we talked about last week or something. Okay, if the frame is outside these ranges, it is dropped. You do also have jumbo frames, but we're not talking about those at the moment. Okay, I talked about last week the destination MAC address comes first, which is how the switches can key on it. They look for the destination MAC address and then the source MAC address, and that's how you have the fragment-free cut-through and store and forward switching, which I'm sure I talked about last week. With the length type field, this used to be covered in the tests, but it's not really at the moment. If it's less than 1500, it shows the length of the packet. If it is greater than 1536, it shows the type of the packet. If CRC are on a packet being received, if that doesn't match, it just gets ditched. This can happen due to electrical interference and all sorts of other oddities. Now, a unicast packet goes directly to a specific MAC address, and your broadcast MAC address is all ones, and you guys will have seen that in your ARP requests on your Wireshark labs, I'm hoping. IP broadcast, or the non-specific broadcast address for a local network segment, is 255.255.255.255. Can anybody give me an example of a protocol that uses a network of a non-directed network broadcast of 255.255.255.255?
RIP uses that, doesn't it?
It can. I think I'm thinking of another protocol that it starts off with one of those network broadcasty things. Ah, do I need to unlock that? I'll give you a clue. It starts with D.
Oh, DHCP.
It certainly does. The first packet on DHCP is a discover, which is sent to the all ones MAC address and 255.255.255.255. See, I haven't had enough coffee. I can't say that properly. Except I don't drink coffee anymore. There's this stuff on multicast, which is, while it's quite interesting, is also quite complex. So you can read that in your notes. It converts like the lower 23 bits of the MAC address and stuff. We won't worry about that too much because it's not in the tests. Last time last week about carrier sense multiple access with collision detection?
Yes.
Yeah, we did some of that.
So, does everybody understand that it's sort of a bit like a round table discussion where theoretically only one person is speaking at once? Somebody tried to say that it was like a dinner party, but it's not like any of the dinner parties I've ever been to, where one person speaks at a time, and if two people speak at the same time, there's a collision, and we all back off and politely wait for somebody else. That's not how the dinner parties I go to work. But that's theoretically how CSMACD works.
It's kind of like our Ventrilo thing right now that we have going.
Sorry?
It's kind of like the Ventrilo chat class thing that we have going that we're in right now.
Yeah, that's a good example of CSMACD. We try not to talk over the top of each other, and we try and unkey when we hear somebody else transmitting. We don't just keep our key held down because we're thinking about something, and apparently if we let the key go, that's our thought into the ether. It's all right, little issue we had in a couple of previous courses. What's the matter, Grace?
Hat got the highest score.
Oh, excellent. Okay, a hub is known as a multiport repeater, and the hubs and repeaters increase the size of the collision domain. So do we all understand what a collision domain is? Hang on. Let me have a look. Because if you blow this up, it'll bounce them all. Hang on. Yes, certs at Cisco Vision, Gross.
Cool. Thanks so much.
Does everybody know what a collision domain is?
It's basically one network segment, right, that's not separated by a switch? Is that right?
Yeah, kind of. Anybody else got anything to add? Because I thought there was a question on this in the... Say it wasn't real coffee. Wasn't there a question of this in one of the Module 7 exams or something about collision domains? A collision domain is where you have the size of a particular network segment that is set up as a logical bus. So if you've got 8 machines connected to a hub, they will be in one collision domain. If you have 8 machines connected to a switch, they will be separated out into different collision domains because the switch separates hosts out into those collision domains, whereas the hub won't. If you've got 8 machines on a piece of coax, that is one collision domain. Don't confuse collision domain with broadcast domain, which is how far a broadcast datagram will propagate on a network. Okay. So basically they're saying to us, when hubs are connected together, they create an extended star. That's physically speaking. Logically speaking, you've just got a bigger bus. As distances get longer, latency increases because it actually takes time for things to travel down wires on Ethernet, and you get a higher risk of collisions, which is why we have the distance limitations for Ethernet. Your bit times on 10 megabit Ethernet are 100 nanoseconds, and as it goes up, as it goes to 100 megabits, it's 10 nanoseconds, and it goes to a gigabit, it's 1 nanoseconds, so the bit times get smaller and smaller. And I've got a note here that says you cannot have half duplex on 10 gigabit Ethernet, which is fair enough. It says discuss slot time, which is the time it takes for various events on Ethernet to occur. It's a certain number of bit times. I'd have to actually look that up on Wikipedia because I can't remember what it exactly is. So go and have a look at your notes, or I'll go and have a look at your notes and talk about it in more detail next week. And devices must wait 96 bit times. It's called a settle time. It's 96 bit times between frames to allow the transmitters to and receivers, or the transceivers, to recover from frame to frame to frame, so they can take a little break between things coming in. So if you picture Jason and Matthew locked in their call centres there, and a new version of their software has come out and the calls are absolutely pouring in on the switchboard, the settle time is the time they've got to refill the cup of coffee and steel themselves for the next call that they're about to take off the call queue. So that's the idea of a settle time. And I would guess that that time is never long enough. Okay, now interestingly enough, 10 base T uses Manchester encoding, which we talked about last week, over two unshielded twisted pair cables. That is now you can actually run Cat3 on 10 base T Ethernet, but generally speaking, most people use Cat5. If you're putting Cat3 in, I can't understand why you'd do that, unless you had reels and reels and reels and reels of it in the shed and you were setting up a 10 megabit network, and I have no reason why you'd do that either. In the late 90s, they standardized 100 megabit Ethernet. I don't know whether anybody remembers, there was a battle between 100 base TX and VG AnyLAN, and 100 base TX won. A bit like the battle between K56 Flex and V.90. Does anybody remember that? Sorry, K56 Flex and X.2.
I remember that.
Oh, good. I was feeling a bit old for a second there. They had the same thing going on with V.fast and VFC, and then that all got merged and mixed around, and we ended up with V34. My notes say that all sorts of nasty tricks got pulled to make 100 gigabit Ethernet work, or 1 gigabit Ethernet, sorry, work, and that you refer to your notes because it's not something you actually need to know. But basically there's like multiple signals happening at multiple times in both directions at once, and it's all quite messy. Now, this is a rehash of the stuff I was talking about earlier. Hubs causes the media to be shared. latency increases the more hubs you add, because it takes time for a signal to go through a hub, and that increases the chance of a late collision. Now, a late collision is a collision that happens after the preamble is sent out, and they are not actually detected very well. They end up scrambling the packet and causing retransmits, so you want to avoid late collisions if you can. Switch microsegments network reduces collisions. We've talked about that. Switches improve networks because there's dedicated bandwidth to each port. Collision-free environment, because it's usually most modern switches are full duplex, so you don't have the concept of collisions. Full duplex operation, which is what I just said. And that's the end of that chapter. All right. Anyone still awake?
Do we have to?
Okay. Do we want to stop there, or do I want to go on and do some of the stuff out of Module 10?
I wouldn't mind covering some of the stuff in 10.
I'll be honest and tell you I haven't read 10 yet. I remember your story from orientation.
Well, yeah, but at least if I know beforehand, I can have some expectations of you guys not actually having read 10, and that's all right. When I turn up to the lecture and I've told people like 2 weeks beforehand that I want Module 3 read and nobody's actually read it, that's when I'm likely to get cranky. But it's all right. I'm not going to, you know, DAC F4 and walk out because you haven't read Module 10 yet.
It doesn't matter. You still need to tell that in every orientation.
Yeah, I think so. Grace,
yeah?
Can you zap down when you get a chance and grab me a quench? Alrighty. Cabling a network. So we're going on to the stuff in Module 10. It's probably worth mentioning that next year we are running courses, and if you know of anybody who would you should point in our direction, please point them in our direction, ciscovision.org or caviinfo@ciscovision.org. We are taking enrolments next semester for people in our classes. I thought that was pretty obvious, but I just thought I'd mention it.
Is Exploration 1 being run again?
Yes, Exploration 1 is being run again as far as I know. And I think Exploration 2 will be being run as well. Sorry, did that cover your question, Jason?
Yeah, I just wondered if when they're going to put out the announcement for Exploration 2 and all.
We've got to modify the website and change, like, you know, S/2011/2012/G through all of our documents and through a few file names and a few web pages, and the announcements will go out. Probably around a similar time. We tend to do it at sort of one universal because it suits a lot of people. I mean, if you do it afternoons Perth time, then US people don't want to do it. And I find going to sleep difficult if I'm teaching a course at 10 o'clock at night. It can be done, but it hasn't sort of been done before in that sort of way. If there was a real push, to run the Linux course, see, a lot of people work, so it's not really convenient to run it in the morning US time, because a lot of people need to go to work. So that's sort of why we've stuck to mornings Perth time so far. But if somebody has a compelling argument for otherwise, we'll listen to you.
Yeah, mornings Perth time, the current time schedule works pretty well for me. I just wondered, as far as running so many classes, if it's how that's going to all fit in.
That's fine. I'm not actually going to go into the academy to teach some of my classes, so you'll find that ITE1 and Exploration 2, say for example, might run on the Ventrilo server at the same time.
Okay.
Tabling a network. Before devices can communicate, you need to cable a network. Funny that. You need to plan how this is going to happen. This is not come home with a bag of stuff and think you're going to hook it up and then realize that you don't have enough cable to run from this room to that room and that really the wireless would have been a good idea except there are 6 brick walls in the way. And you've really got to have a think about how you're going to run this stuff before you start drilling holes through walls, power cables, which we don't recommend, and various other nastiness. Has anybody got in-house cabling on this channel or on this discussion, or are most people running cables just over the back of the desk and round behind the bookcase and all that sort of stuff?
I did some of it in our previous office, but don't have anything that lovely here at home.
Yeah, look, I'm sure people are aware that cable messiness can be a problem. And that in my experience, cables will tend to wrap around every single other cable, and that the cable that you most want to pull out will be under 6 of the other ones that you haven't touched in years. And I don't know how that happens, but the one you actually want to pull out is usually worked its way to the bottom. Ta. When you're inside, hubs and switches connect LANs together. We've pretty much covered that. The type of router you're going to use is decided by what sort of media you've got and the features you want. Obviously, if you have a two-wire router, it may not have some of the advanced features that you would expect from every other router. I'm not just having a go at two-wire because they're two-wire, but they do tend to be one of those routers that isn't sort of feature-rich, depending on which one you've got. The other thing you'll tend to find, and I don't know whether it's true over in America as well, but the routers that your ISPs will give you for free are not particularly feature-rich, but they will do the job.
They usually run a custom ROM that the ISP has modified, right, to lock out some of the features or whatever?
That can happen with some of them, certainly.
They're no Mikrotik, that's for sure.
Well, I wasn't even going to mention them today. I've already had my little Mikrotik happy dance with the wireless 5-port routers with USB that are sitting under my desk, as previously mentioned. But we're not talking about that. Routers break up collision and broadcast domains. So you don't get broadcasts that follow... That cross across routers. Now, this is important because if you get too much broadcast traffic, you can end up with broadcast storms, and this can greatly diminish the efficiency of your network. They tend to prefer switches over hubs because, well, hubs are hard to buy and they tend to get a bit expensive, and unless you're really that budget conscious, you just want to go out and get switches. You don't want to use hubs because you get more collisions and that makes things inefficient. Stuff you've got to think about. How much do you want to spend? Speed and types of interfaces. That's important as well. Expandability. That's for the network, not you. Manageability. If you have a whole stack of dumb switches, you can't exactly do much with them except plug cables into them. If you have some semi-smart switches or some smart switches, you actually get some diagnostics. And that can be quite useful. I upgraded my network from some dumb Netgear switches to some semi-smart Linksys SL2008s. One of the things that the web interface allows me to do on those switches, which can be quite handy, is have a look at the link state of all of the ports on the switch and see which ports have got link state and which ports don't. And that is a very useful. If I have enough connectivity to get into the switch on at least one port, it's one way of me telling whether the light on a particular port is on or not.
I assume we can do that with the switches on the bundle too.
Oh yes, most certainly. You can get all sorts of information out of those switches about which ports are on and which groups they're in and all that sort of stuff.
That's pretty neat. I'll have to have a look at that sometime.
They're actually saying here, I mean, I've actually seen some contrary advice to this, but they're saying that often cost per port would mean one large switch is a good idea. You can actually save on cable costs by having some smaller switches, but I saw an article on Tech Republic that said that daisy chaining switches can also be problematic. So you've basically got to look at your setup and make some informed decisions on which way you want to go with all of that. If a switch fails, the network goes down, so plan for some redundancy if you can. The little SL2008 switches I've got at home, they actually have a redundancy setup where you can actually run, well, it's if a cable dies or whatever, you can actually run redundant links between the switches, and it will either load balance those links, or it will utilize one of those links if, in case one of those other links becomes inoperable. They're saying here, plan for a little expansion. If you've got 22 PCs, you might buy a 24-port switch, or you might go for the one up, because if you're expecting to get more PCs, it can be quite expensive to replace an entire switch. The other thing you've got to consider is, how many ports do you need at what speed? If you are running a regular desktop that is not multimedia media heavy, often 100 megabit is sufficient. A lot of people run their only computer on wireless, and if you've got some sort of file server or whatever, you will know exactly how tedious it is to copy things over wireless networks. This is an interesting point, actually. I don't know whether the same is true under Windows 7, but did anybody ever notice that if you had a wired Ethernet connection and a wireless connection under Windows XP, the wireless would still take preference over the wired connection?
Yes, I did run into that.
I usually tend to disable the connections that I'm not using for that exact reason, to stop it from preferring a slower connection medium than it should actually do. Now, let's see. They're talking about choosing routers here. They're saying that modular routers allow interface cards to be added. However, you need to be careful, because certain routers won't let you add certain interfaces, so that is fun and games on the Cisco router chooser and bouncing off their website. Actually, to be fair, Mikrotik is just as bad at this. You need to find out, for example, that the 400 whatever it is has wireless, but is the wireless capable of doing access point or infrastructure? Access point or client mode, and how many ports has it got, and what speed and stuff. So you really have to pay attention to whatever router you've got from whatever brand, whether it has all of the features you want. Now, this isn't directly relevant, but it's worth mentioning here as a matter of course. Has anybody ever been in the situation where you get one wireless router and you discover that you put it in the house and you can't get signal down to Auntie Mabel's back bedroom, and you don't really want Auntie Mabel using her laptop somewhere else in the house, because she yells and swears at her Facebook feed and you don't really want to put up with that while watching television? Has anybody ever discovered that when you're playing with wireless routers, that not all of them support WDS, and it can be quite difficult to add a second wireless router into your house if you don't have wired infrastructure?
Yeah, I've seen that.
For those of you where one wireless network will cover the entire house, you lucky, lucky people. It's not everybody's always that lucky. Especially with dead spots and the like. Depending on what operating system the router runs, governs what features you've got. Now we've got notes on, so for example, some routers will do VPN, some will do IPsec, some will do layer 2 switching, layer 3 switching, all that sort of stuff. It just depends on what operating system you're running. And as far as Cisco is concerned, there's all different sorts of iOS versions with different letters on the end of them that all cost different amounts of lots of money that actually decide what your router can and what your router can't do. So with cables, you are considering the work area. If you're doing a big place, you can have a telecommunications room, and you're going to have patch panels, and you're going to have the good stuff. If you're in a house, you're probably going to have network cables, cable hooks, 3M. TM makes some cable hooks that apparently hook onto walls and don't leave nasty marks on your paintwork when they fall off, and can hold a certain amount of cable, so that's always good. Now, the other thing they're talking about here is they're talking about the different types of cable you can have. You can have your backbone cabling, which is your high-speed runs between various switches. You've got your distribution cabling, which gets things out to wall panels and things. And then you've got your drop leads that take you from the wall panel down to your workstation. Note that the maximum length of a UTP cable between switch and workstation is 100 meters. So if you want more length, you will need to daisy chain switches or pull other tricks. Your telecommunications room, depending on your company, it can hold routers, switches, and depending on what you've organized, servers as well. So it's the really noisy place with all the expensive air conditioning to keep everything at a reasonable temperature. They're saying that the length of cables from the comms room to the patch panel shouldn't exceed 90 meters. And they say that the backbone cabling can connect the communications rooms together, and it can also connect to wide area networks or other buildings. Any questions so far? Yes, go ahead, John.
Does the backbone cabling, does that also have length limitations of 100 meters, or is it different for that?
It depends on what you're running at the backbone cabling. You often run fiber as your backbone cable, and so you're probably running single mode or multi mode fiber, not twisted pair generally. Okay.
Subscriber optical connectors. I've never seen one. Do they look similar to a analog coax connector?
No. They have you ever seen SPDIF? They look like that.
I don't think so.
They're a sort of a square connector with one pin at the end of it, which is where the fiber is, and they push into these. I think they're sort of square holes, and then the pin sort of sits in the middle. You may see it on home theater equipment or on the backs of some PCs have got this sort of round hole for the pin with a little flap that swings shut when nothing's connected into it to stop dust from getting into the end of it. I'm not sure whether... Has anybody else on here seen SPDIF connectors in the past?
That's like the little optical connector. And I've seen it, like the front of my thing here has little covers that you can pull off. And it's an optical cable. Never used it. Or else I've seen the other one where, like you said, there's a little door you push in.
Yeah, that's right. They're the sort of subscriber connectors we're looking at. Because you've got to keep in mind that fibre is very thin. So a single fibre is maybe a couple of mils across, maybe maximum 3 mils across if you include all of the jacketing and stuff on it. It's very thin, and it... You have one fibre for each direction, so generally you have two subscriber connectors next to each other and the fibres are actually stuck together, and you plug the two connectors into the two subscriber connectors, and that gives you your full duplex communication. Okay, when you're choosing your media, you need to consider how long does the cable need to be? Does it go across rooms or from building to building? Cost. Can we afford fibre? Should we be using fibre? What are the advantages between fibre and twisted pair? Interesting story, very briefly. We had a girl in one of my TAFE classes. TAFE is our technical college for further education, although I used to ask myself whether further education actually did happen in some cases. And they had an assignment where they had a 6x8 office with 4 computers in it. And this girl, Sarah was her name, was cabling this office, and she decided that she was going to run 100 metres of cable to every PC. We'd have the switch up the front of the room, and we'd run 100 metres of cable to every PC. And I said, well, isn't there a bit of a problem with that? You know, cable is $2 a metre. This was sort of back in the late 90s. Cable is $2 a metre, and she's like, that's okay. I've got $2,000 in my budget for cabling. And I said, well, don't you think there's another problem with this? This is a 6 metre by 8 metre office, or for you Americans, that's about 18 feet by 24 feet. And it took me about 5 minutes to convince this girl that not only at $2 a metre for 100 metres of cable for every PC, because the cable can be a maximum length of 100 metres, so we might as well run 100 metres, I actually got her thinking about what was she going to do with the rest of the cable and all these 100 metre runs. Were we going to coil it up under the desk, or exactly what was going to go on with that? So that was quite a challenging network design experience.
Sarah's gone on to IT administration now.
No, I think she's now a school teacher.
Even better.
Oh, yes. I think we'd only done like 6 months of hardware, and somebody said to her, okay, you'll need a Phillips head screwdriver to take out those screws on the back of that machine to open it up. And Sarah was standing staring blankly at her computer, a look of utter confusion on her face, which wasn't that uncommon. And somebody came over to her and said, here you go, sweetie. It's the star-shaped one. They're the flat ones. That's a flat head. And this is the Phillips head. You want this one. Our next problem was, which way around do you have to spin the screws to take them out? So, it's all good.
And now Australia's future is in her hands. Excellent.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Now, we'll work on sending it to Canada or something. Okay, the other thing you've got to consider is bandwidth. Does the media you're using provide adequate bandwidth? If you're still running all that Cat 3 cable through your house because you were too tight to buy some new stuff and there was this roll of it in your uncle's shed, and then you go to put in gigabit switches and the whole thing goes down in a pile of not workingness, that's probably not so cool. I would be strongly suggesting, if you are putting new cabling into your house or you're going to put any more cable in, that you start by putting it in as Cat 6. And if you're buying patch leads, just get the Cat 6 ones, because gigabit works better on Cat 6. The pairs are better separated. It tends to be better quality cable, and the saving that you're going to make on buying that Cat 5 stuff is not amazing.
Now, what would happen, actually, if you try to... Oops.
Go ahead. You're on.
What will happen if you try to push too much bandwidth through, Cat 3 or something? Will it just not work, or will you drop packets, or what does it do?
It becomes really slow and laggy and unresponsive. You can lose packets. For example, with Cat 3, which is only 4 pairs, if you just give me a second, I'm just going to unlock this storeroom. Okay, there we go. Cat 3 has only got 4 wires in it. So that will run 100 megabit Ethernet okay, but Gigabit actually requires the full 8 wires, so if you plug Cat 3 into Gigabit, it won't work at all.
Okay.
The other thing you'll find is if you're running Cat5e on Gigabit and you're doing it for long runs of, you know, 80, 90 meters, things can get flaky. Whereas if you replace that 80, 90 run with a thing of Cat6, it will all start working and it will be happy. The other thing you've got to consider is how hard is it going to be to install? Are you guys going to install it, or are you going to have to get some vendor or something to install it at prodigious cost? How much EMI or RFI have you got in the local environment? Are you dealing with things like fluorescent lights, motors, those sorts of things? You normally run cables in raceways, which are these sort of channel things that you run them in, but you do need to be careful with optical fibre. You can't bend it too tightly, otherwise the light won't go around the corner. You can use wireless networks. Okay, here's an interesting question. How many wireless networks do people tend to see from their houses these days? Like, if you do a scan for wireless networks, how many do you usually find? I think we've got about 5 or 6.
Yeah, I've got something close to that.
Which is a good point, is when there's more networks than there are channels, how many networks can each channel support?
That all depends on how far the networks are away from you, and how good their transmitters and receivers are. A lot of people don't realise that the wireless channels overlap, and it's 1, 5 and 10 that don't overlap. I think, was it 1, 5 and 11? No, I think it's 1, 5 and 11 that don't overlap. So there is a little bit of overlap on all the channels because they are 22 megahertz wide. But there is some, I think this was in the Wikipedia article on 802.11. It all depends on what's in your area and how much noise and stuff is around the area. So if you've got, this is why it's important for not only should you measure wireless signal strength, but you should also look at the noise that the card is picking up. So if you've got noise at minus 84 dBm or something, that is going to make a difference when your wireless signals get down low. The Intel drivers tend to be very good at doing site survey and can look at those sort of noise and signal, because the signal and the noise is important. Basically, you need to figure out which channel is going to be quieter for your devices depending on the location of the networks that you're looking at. And it's up to you whether you just look at what Windows will show you in the scan for wireless networks, or whether you look at something like Kismet, which doesn't work very well under Windows, so get yourself a Unix to run it on it. May I recommend GRML? Or something like that to actually look at how strong the signals are and what you're seeing. Most of the time, you just mess around with channels until you find one that works well and gives you high speed, unless you're being scientific and technical about it. But my point is that the 2.4 GHz spectrum is filling up, especially with Bluetooth and mobile phone, well, not mobile phones, Bluetooth and cordless phones and wireless networks. It's becoming quite a busy spectrum, and often you don't have the option of convincing your neighbours to change channel. Okay. Now, they're talking about the RJ45 connector. It is specified by EIA/TIA. Pin numbers from 8 to 1 when viewed from the front. So, if the actual opening gate, or I call them tunkers, is facing you, the cables are 1 to 8. That's where the pins are, that way. T568A and T568B, they have the transmit and receive pairs 1, 2, and 3 and 6 swapped over. So if you put T568A on one end of a cable and T568B on the other, you will end up with a crossover cable. If you put A on one end and B A on the other end, and A on one end and B on 17426. If you put A on one end and A on the other, or B on one end and B on the other, you will end up with a situation where you have a straight through cable. You tend to use 568A for workstations. And your MDIX is usually 568B, which is your crossover configuration used by workstations and switches. You use straight through cables for connecting switch to router, computer to switch, computer to hub, and you use crossover cables for switch to switch, switch to hub, hub to hub, and router to router. Also, if you're connecting two computers together. And computer to router. A lot of computers, though, have auto crossover logic, and this isn't as important as it once was. The network card will tend to cross over the pins and work it out for you. Some devices, you can change them from MDI to MDIX. Sometimes that's done with a switch, sometimes that's done with a button. I don't know whether everybody's seen those 9-port switches where you've got port 1 to 8 and then port 9 is the uplink, but if you plug something into the uplink you can't use port 8, which just means that port 8 and 9 share the same set of wires, except 9 has its crossover send and receive pairs swapped over. Has anyone seen that sort of layout? Media dependent interface. I'm just about to Google up a definition of the exact acronym expansion for MDIX. They're all called media-dependent interface, and there's an article on it in Wikipedia. So, yeah, knock yourself out. And there's even a Wikipedia entry on an Ethernet crossover cable. How about that? You've either got software configuration that can switch these pairs over, a button or a switch or something. Now they're going to talk about the difference between DCE and DTE. So DCE provides the clocking, C is for clock, and it is used at the provider end because the provider will charge you for a faster clock signal. And the DTE is the equipment at the customer's end, or the client's end, and you receive the clock signal from the DCE. You guys won't have actually seen how the racks are actually laid out here, but you guys actually have a V.35 cable, and they actually simulate DCE to DTE based on the connectors and stuff in the middle of the cable, and that is how, with router 2, you guys have to set the clock rates on router 2, because it's set up as a DCE because it's supposed to be the ISP, and then the DTEs are router 1 and router 3 on the remote switch.
Carrie, I'd asked this before, but on my routers, they don't use V35 connectors. The interface cards actually use RJ48s. Do you know on those what determines whether it's DCE or DTE, or is it just which one you set up on which router? Do you have any idea?
No, unfortunately not. I do not know about those connectors. I've never come across the V48 before.
No, it's RJ48. It looks exactly like an RJ45. It's just, I guess, wired a bit differently.
Yeah, no, I honestly wouldn't know. I have to do a little bit of research on that. And that's approximately what we've got for this module. So, any questions, queries, and stuff before we hit stop?
So, just module 9, the module 9 lab, kind of as far as roughly keeping to schedule for next week, would that be what we should aim at?
Try to get the 8 and 9 lab done by next week. I will try and look through module 9 lab and see how much modification it needs. but shouldn't be too bad.
It looks like there's one for 9 that you've already done, which is the ARP one that I was grumbling about earlier. And if there are going to be the ones for 10 and 11, it looks like you haven't got to those yet.
Yeah, I've got to sit down and do that.